is an interview conducted by Felicity Aston with Jenny Bonner at her home in Monmouthshire on the 24th of March 2011.
I'm Jennifer Mary Bonner, and I was born on the 18th of May 1931 in London.
Thanks very much. Okay, so Jenny, you completed your degree at University College London.
Yes.
So what made you want to study botany and zoology? How did that come about? Was that an interest from childhood? Or?
I think it was the only subject I was really good at school.
And so getting to UCL, was that a big sort of achievement for you? Was that the ambition? What was the ambition?
My father was a doctor, and originally I thought I wanted to follow him as a GP. But then I decided I didn't. And my family wanted me to go to university. And I lived in London, and so it would be cheaper to go to a London college. And so I applied for University College London, and I got in to do intermediate BSc, which was the same as first MB, same as nowadays about A-level.
And did you come from a particularly academic family?
Was this... My father was academic. My mother was very intelligent, but wasn't academic. But it was just that's something they want. I think because I had a sister and not a brother. My father wanted me as the eldest daughter to go to university, and he'd have loved me to have followed in his footsteps. But no, it was just sort of something that I was expected to do, and the school I went to sort of expected me to go to university, so it didn't seem a big deal.
So at UCL, I mean, were there lots of women at that time doing...
Oh, yes, lots of women. I think there were more men than women, but it wasn't hugely outnumbered. And it was just, the building was still bombed. When we were there, they started to rebuild it.
Oh, right, from the war.
From the bombing in the war, because the war finished in 1945. And I went originally in 1949.
Right, and how long were you there studying?
Just 3 years, because I did a general degree, which in those days was 2 years long. But I had to be at college for 3 years, and because I've done intermediate BSc, that counted, although I didn't realise that when I went to do it.
Yeah. And did it come very easily to you?
Well, the botany and zoology came, but the chemistry didn't come very easily at all. And in fact, in those days, your degree was your worst subject. And if you failed one subject, you failed your degree. And so I got most people got a pass. And that was because my chemistry wasn't as good as my biology, botany and zoology.
And so what was your intention after...
To go into teaching. Those who can do, those who can't teach.
But while you were studying there, you met Nigel.
Nigel, yes. When I started my degree, he did chemistry as a subsidiary subject to an honours zoology degree. And that's where we met, in the chemistry lab.
And so what did you think of him when you first met him?
I was rather superior. I just finished a relationship, and I was going to work. I wasn't going to get involved with men. And in those days, you called each other Mr. Bonner and Miss Sachs until you really got to know each other. And so apparently I was rather standoffish.
And you also met some other people that went on to work for...
Yes, kids. Bernard Stonehouse, who had been on the Shetland Islands, South Shetlands. Was it South Shetland. The name escapes me where they were. It's not a base any longer. There was a volcanic eruption there.
Oh, Deception Island.
That's right. And that was when it was a military organisation. He went down he was in the Navy as a pilot. And while he was down there, he studied the emperor penguins. And what he wanted to do was to study the king penguins in South Georgia after his degree, to compare them with the emperors. And of course, he couldn't go down on his own, so he just sort of said, does anybody want to come to South Georgia? And Nigel thought that might be an interesting thing to do, although his plan originally was to do entomology, and that was, he was specialising in that, and to go to Africa. Well, this seemed something to do, so he went to South Georgia to study elephant seals.
And so before Bernard Stonehouse came up with this idea, Nigel didn't have any intention of particularly going to Antarctica.
No, not at all.
So when he told you that he was planning to go to South Georgia, what did you think?
We were going out, but we weren't expected to marry. So that seemed quite a good idea, really.
Well, I mean, I wondered, was it something that you thought, actually, I'd quite like to go and do that? Was there any sort of...
No. And I suppose that was at the beginning of the final year. And I suppose we got closer during that final year. He was doing his final year for his degree. I'd got my degree and was doing my PGCE during that year. And I didn't think it was such a good idea that he was going for 18 months when he actually went.
Why? Because it might damage his career?
No, because I just wanted him with me.
Was it seen as quite an adventurous thing to be going and doing at
yes.
the time?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was.
Bernard and Nigel went off to Antarctica in July 1953.
Yes.
And then in the meantime you started your teaching.
Yes. It took me a little while to control the children, but once I'd learnt that art, I really enjoyed teaching.
And did you hear from Nigel while he was...
Yes. We wrote, and he knew when he arrived, the day he arrived in South Georgia, he had a terrific pain in his abdomen and was diagnosed with appendicitis. But the doctor down there at the time, the winter doctor, the administrative officer, didn't want him to operate on his own. And so they waited until a Welsh doctor came down, which was a couple of days. And then the Welsh doctor, who was only just out of college, just got his medical degree, operated on him. But he'd had so much morphine that the Welsh doctor wasn't keen on giving him a general anaesthetic. So they gave him a spinal anaesthetic, so he could see David paging through the book to see what he had to do next. And then finally, the spinal anaesthetic wore out, and Nigel said, excuse me, I can feel you. And so they had to give him ether, or chloroform, I suppose it was. And he survived, which says something for David Richards' efforts. And so he didn't join Bernard for about, I can't remember exactly how long, but it was a long time, a couple of months before, or may even have been 3 months before he was allowed to go and join Bernard. And the first I knew of it was Bernard sent me a telegram to say he was better, because I wasn't next of kin. And then, but all the time we were writing letters and just sending them off. Nigel was sending them off knowingly onto boats, but I was just sending them off into the ether. So I think I could send 20 page, small pages of Basildon Bond. I can't remember. I think it may have been sixpence. But in 6D. And then they used to come from Nigel in huge, great bundles. And the postman used to sort of play a little tune on our doorbell when they came so that I knew when it would arrive. So, but yes, pages and pages went between us.
So then he came back.
He came back in, it must have been about March. Yes, 1955.
So he'd been away
2 years. He'd been away 18 months. And yes, and about 14 months at the Bay of Isles. And he came back and we decided we did want to marry, and we married in August of that year.
Oh, and did he know that he was going to
no,
go back?
No, we thought, he thought and we thought that he was going to settle back into academia and write, do his doctorate and go on to lecture or something at university. And then he was offered the chance to go down again. And so on our first wedding anniversary, he was back again, on his way back to South Georgia, to act as sealing inspector and do what research he wanted to, biological research, as and when he could. And so he studied the flora and he studied the reindeer, and he was able to, in at the end of the season, go to Bird Island, where he discovered a thriving colony of fur seals.
So when Nigel went back the second time, were you really supportive of that, or did you think, oh my goodness, off he goes?
Yes,
again.
I think I was supportive. But a bit miffed, I suppose. But I had my work, and I just thought it was going to be the one time, and just to collect more information, you know, more material for his elephant seal work. But then, having found these fur seals, which was a really exciting thing. He was, when they asked him if he'd go back again. No, well, we better go back again. When he got to South Georgia that second time he went down, everybody on South Georgia, or at the point, the government station, had expected me to come down with him. They hadn't expected him to come on his own. And they'd all presumed that Bob Spivey, who was the administrative officer and an ex-FID, we would stay at the magistrate's house on the point with him. And in fact, Nigel did stay there. And they were talking about it at a meal one day with the manager of Hoodsvik Whaling Station. And the manager said, well, why doesn't she come down on Tyre? it's coming down in January. And Bob said, yes, send her a cable and ask if she can come down on tyre. And so I thought, the man's mad, but never mind, I'll ask for leave from work, because, of course, I was going to miss the whole of the Easter term. And I got leave and got in touch with the whaling company, which was called Tonsberg Hvalfangeri, which was based in Tonsberg in Norway, and went to Denmark, Copenhagen, to join the boat, and were told that the boat was delayed, so we stayed in Copenhagen for about the best part of a week. And by this time, I joined up with two government people going down to the point, the single men's steward, Cyril Stroyer, who was always called Tonk, and a customs officer whose name, John, but his name has escaped me. And also the wife of Dick Brown, who was on was a glaciologist and was on a private expedition. And I don't think she had government permission to go down. I think she was private completely. And there was also the wife of either a meteorologist or wireless operator. I think he was a wireless operator. She had two children, and so we had met up and there, and then went to North Denmark to catch the boat. And it worked out that a week after I'd left England, we were back in the English Channel. And we set off on this mega voyage. We were going to Aruba to get fuel, but fuel transpired that it was cheaper in Carapito in Venezuela. So we went across to round Trinidad and up the San Juan River for a night and almost a day through the forest, which came right down to the river. It was quite fascinating going up the river to this little port, well, jetty really, in the middle of nowhere, where the fuel oil could be loaded. But the actual oil depot was inland. And all the... Do you want to move?
That's right, I could just hear the knocking of the table, it's fine.
Sorry. All the men, because we had a number of whalers on board who were going down for the winter to repair ships and do work on the stations and that sort of thing. And they all shot ashore and disappeared into the jungle. And the women were told that we were to stay on board, or we could go to the Seaman's Mission at the jetty. So we went down to the Seaman's Mission for a little while, but everything was extremely expensive there and there wasn't really much to do, so we came back on board. And then, of course, the men returned, very drunk. And so we just went into our cabins, locked the doors and went to bed. Let all that mayhem continue. But the journey, there was quite a lot of activity during the journey. We had the Norwegians, seamen anyway, find it quite easy, men dancing together. So they often had dances. And on this occasion, there was not only were the three English women going down, there was also the captain's wife and the steward's wife. So there were five women, so once it was we were into the tropics, we used to have dances on board, on deck, and there were cinema showings and sort of activities, silly games, one of which I remember was trying to get an elastic band from under your nose down to your chin without touching anything. And at other times we just played cards and sat in our mess, because there was a sort of visitor's mess. And the officers used to come and sit with us and talk, and we play games, card games and other games.
What was the sort of berthing conditions like and the living conditions?
The living conditions on Tota were extremely comfortable. We each had a cabin to ourselves, which had two bunks in it and a settee, and hot and cold running water to a basin. And it was very tastefully decorated in the sort of Scandinavian style that we thought of as being Scandinavian style. So it was very comfortable, and the mess room was comfortable, quite large. And they, because they got five women on board, they decided that they'd set up a swimming pool and have a crossing the line ceremony. And we had a little confab about what we'd do about this. And in the end, we decided that we'd pretend it was a sort of beauty contest, because we'd have to wear swimming costumes, which was the whole point of the exercise. And so we wore swimming costumes and big hats, and we made sashes to go across us. And we had mistake and mishap, and the little girl was mischief. And we carried sort of numbers like they do on beauty things. And they were very good, actually. They tipped us very gently back into the water. And then the captain insisted on the swimming pool being removed. We never actually swam it. It was just sort of tarpaulin erected for this exercise. But yes, it was a good time. I got 6 weeks was too long. I can't imagine how people go for cruises for 3 months.
And had any of these women made this journey before? Had
no.
The majority of people?
Oh, yes. The stewardess had, the Norwegian stewardess. But I'm not sure about the captain's wife, probably.
And so was there sort of a sense of anticipation, perhaps a bit of nerves about what you were sailing into?
Oh, yes, we hadn't a clue. And the two young men that were going down didn't know. Tonk had been in a boy. I think he started off in the Navy as a boy and then transferred to the Army. And then when he left the Army, he didn't know what to do. So he thought, I don't think he had any skill at cooking, but he applied to go down to South Georgia to cook for the men. He didn't stay in that job very long.
Oh dear. And so then after 6 weeks you finally arrived in
yes.
South Georgia. I mean, when you first saw South Georgia, what
well
what
I
did
didn't
you
see you South Georgia, because it was extremely windy and we were stood off and we couldn't see a thing because everything was covered by cloud. And that wasn't covered by cloud was covered by spray, because it was so windy we couldn't get near South Georgia. We stood off for quite a long time. And then I was just so relieved to get off the boat. And we got to Husvik, which was where Tyre was going, and was met by Nigel and some other of the PEEP staff. And we went round on one of the whale boats to the point straight away. And Spivey, who had to do all the administration of getting the boat, signing the boat in and checking it over for customs incursions, or was over there. So we had the house to ourselves, which was rather lovely. And then I gradually got to meet everybody on the point and at the way at Pesca with Grytviken, which was the whaling company was always known as Pesca, because it was the Compañía Argentina de Pesca was the company that owned it, based in Buenos Aires, and we always called it Pesca.
So what was Husvik like? What was your...
I didn't really see Husvik at all that time. And I didn't see... And we came round to... We came round straight to the Point Jetty and got off at the Point Jetty. And then it was dark, so I didn't really, by that time, didn't really see anything. And I'm very tired. And just collapsed, I think.
And what about the point?
Well, the point was... I mean, I'd seen photographs, but it was just this... have you been to the point? It was this settlement of small wooden buildings, single-storied. A tiny, tiny, more... I suppose there were 25 people living there. And there were five children there when I was there. Betty and Basil's three children were there, I think. Betty and Basil... No, they weren't, because I don't think Betty and Basil were there. I could find out, but... and then we just... Our days were pretty full. The previous administrative officer, Ken Butler, and his wife were living... He was manager of Pesca then. And Nigel, he'd been the administrative officer when Nigel and Bernard had gone down, so Nigel knew them very well. And so we went over there and spent quite a lot of time there. Ken had been a FID in the days when it was, he was ex-army, and he'd been a FID when it was a military operation. And... So when we hadn't got much to do, we used to walk round to Pesca and go and visit Jean and often stay for supper. We sometimes went over for lunch. And while we were there, while I was there, we were pretty busy. We did go to Pesca, to Leith, Salverson station, and stay the night there. And we went to Husvik and just for the day. And we walked over to Mývikan and we went to Hester Sletten and we went to Pesca and two or three times to walk round on our own round the station and find out about it or show me how it all went together. And we, as I say, spent a lot of time with Jean and... Ken. And then after 11 days, the only thing you know about the Antarctic for certain is that nothing's certain. And so I'd expected A, to get there earlier so I'd have longer, and B, to stay longer. But the transport and everything worked out. So Nigel and I came home on Tyre, sharing the cabin that I'd been in on the way down. But it only took 4 weeks to get back and to Norway. And we had 3 or 4 days in Norway and then back onto Tyre and came back to the UK.
So, did it seem like an incredibly short period of time after that huge long journey? down there and equally long journey back?
Well, looking back on it, it did. For the whole thing was such an exciting expedition for me that at the time I felt I'd like to have stayed longer. But I didn't feel... I think it wasn't until I got back and looked back on it that I thought, gosh, why did I do that? But it did make me understand why Nigel wanted to go back. I mean, it's the most beautiful place. And I enjoyed being there. I was made enormously welcome by all the people on the point, all the people I met at all the whaling stations. But I just thought that was a wonderful experience, and Nigel would go back to doing his research and I'd go back to teaching. And then they suggested he should go down again. And in those days, you didn't have one-year contracts. You just had a job and stayed in it. And so we did think about that very carefully. Nigel desperately wanted to go back to study the fur seals. And we decided that if he did go back, I would go with him. Then what would we do after another year? Would he get another contract? He'd broken, you know, would he? So we decided that we'd ask that I should go down and we should have a house. That he should have, no, so first of all, a 5-year contract. I should go with him. And his salary should be doubled. Because we were earning about the same at the time. And, of course, I was stopping earning. And he said, well, you've managed, you know, when we decided this, he said, well, that means that I won't go. So off he went for the interview and he came back and said, they've accepted all my conditions. And we wondered what else we should have asked for. But I don't think they'd have accepted much else.
So your impressions of South Georgia must have been quite favourable when you came back. But about the towns, I mean, the whaling stations must have been quite male-dominated, busy places.
Oh, absolutely. They were entirely male-dominated. Really, occasionally there was one, I don't think there were more than one woman on the... Sometimes the winter station manager had a wife, and sometimes the summer station manager had a wife, and the only times there were two women on a station was when they crossed over, or when one of the boats came down with a stewardess on board. But normally there wasn't a woman on the stations, and if there was, there was only one.
And were they quite industrial places?
Oh, entirely industrial. I mean, during the season, they worked 24 hours if there were whales coming in. There were the whaling, the crew of the whalers were at Gritvik, and there were five main whaling boats and two others, 7 boats in all going to sea. There was the crew of the sealing boats, who the sealing happened before the whaling, the month before the whaling starting, the sealing happened. So they had other jobs on the base. And then there were all the necessary trades to repair a ship, engineers, welders, riveters, blacksmiths, electricians, carpenters, and even things like mold makers, pattern makers, to make out of wood patterns to cast equipment. So to replace something on the whaling boat, if they hadn't got it installed, they made it. And then, of course, there were the ancillary things like bakers, butchers, pig man who looked after, there were pigs on the whaling station, and he looked after the pigs and the chickens, and he had tame doves, which wouldn't be allowed nowadays, and the hospital with, there was one doctor on the island during the winter and three doctors during the season, one at each station. And then if they, their only job was emergencies, really. And if they had an emergency and had to do an operation, then a doctor would come round from one of the other stations.
And what was the sort of atmosphere like on the stations? Was it sort of men far from home, focused on their job, or was it, were they quite homely places, or were they a bit intimidating?
Well, they were run really like ships, I suppose. I mean, even the foremen were in dormitories. And they had messes, and they worked all the time. If there weren't whales in, then they worked 9 till 5 or 8 till 5. If there were whales in, as I say, those who needed to work worked. And of course, there were the people who worked in the factory. So there were the people who ran the boilers, and the people who cut up the whales, and there was a diesel engine, so there were diesel mechanics to make the generate the electricity. There was the wireless operator, who was very important. There was a hydroelectric power station, and so there was somebody manning that.
And was it quite sort of shocking for you seeing that all, the actual whaling and the sealing as a zoo?
I didn't see any sealing at all, because all the areas round the inhabited areas were closed areas, so that you never saw the sealing. I never actually saw I was never close to the seal boats, because when I was down there, I had Martin, so it would have been difficult for me to get across to when the seal boats came in with the seal skins on. So I never saw that. The whaling, we were less squeamish in those days. Presented with a rabbit fully clothed, it wouldn't have surprised me. I would have been able to skin it and clean it without any difficulty, because that's what my mother did during the war, or even though she was a doctor's wife in London. You know, rabbits were off rations, so when they came in, you got one. And so I think we were less squeamish, although we were aware, very aware, and so were the whalers, that they were having to go further and further out to sea to catch the whales, and therefore they were depleting the stocks. And they all felt it was very wrong, and we did too. And Nigel actually mentioned this to somebody from head office at one of the whaling stations, and they said, yes, but we've paid for the equipment, so what we'll do is get as much profit out of it and then close down, cut our losses and go on to another organisation. So that was quite interesting, that was the attitude of the people who were running the commercial side of the organisation. But the whalers themselves felt that they should whale for less time and catch fewer whales, so that it would be, because it was in Norway, it was a very respected job. You know, if you were a whaler, you were a respected member of the community. And they felt that they wanted to leave it for their children. that.
And then the people that you met that first visit, Bob Spivey.
Spivey.
So what are your memories of Bob Spivey and the Matthews?
Do you know, it's strange. I mean, I remember the Matthews I only saw as they came. They had a son when they came. I sort of was the person who greeted them. I cooked them their first meal on the island. They were sort of, you know, getting used to where they were and where they were going to be for the next year anyway. And I honestly can't remember very much about Bob Spivey. Apart from the fact that he was very amenable and a good host, I can't really remember Bob very well at all. We weren't with him very much because he was busy doing things. And when we were with him, we were usually entertaining people. You know, the protector came in, and so the captain and some of the senior officers came up to the house. One of the bass boats came in, so the same thing happened. And then he was off at the other whaling stations, or we were off at the other whaling stations. So I didn't see all that much of him.
And what was his role on South Georgia?
Well, he was the administrative officer, which meant that he was the senior postmaster, the customs officer, the magistrate, which was how he was always called the magistrate, because that's what the Norwegian, the whalers, saw him doing most often. So he was in charge of all the administration. And then he had a customs officer under him. And when I first went, he had one policeman, a bleak stroke handyman, so that his job was actually painting the houses, clearing away the rubbish, all the odd jobs on the island. But then when a ship came in, he put on his police uniform and went over with Bob as the strong arm of the law. And if there was a trial, of course, he was in charge of the prisoner. And then there were three radio operators, three Met men, and a Met forecaster. Later, not that time when I was there, but when I went back, there was a steward for the magistrate, and there was a steward, very often a steward and his wife for the single men. And when I went back again, there was a dentist, because the government provided the dentist, and then in three hospitals there was a dental surgery.
And what about the Matthews? What was their role?
They're exactly the same as Bob Spivey's.
Right. Yeah. And then just going back a little bit to the time, can you just describe a bit about what the ship was? It was an oil tanker.
It was originally an oil tanker, and then they'd converted it into a transporter for people by building up on stilts two decks of cabins and mess rooms and kitchens and things, galleys, so that the waves could break across the tanker deck below the accommodation decks. So it's a very strange-looking ship. But very comfortable accommodation.
And what was the company that it was owned by?
Tonsberg Hvalfangeri, which is whaling.
A whaling in Norwegian.
Hvalfangeri is whaling factory, or whaling business, or yes.
Okay, so I can find out how to spell that.
Yes, it's in Bob Headland's book on South Georgia.
And so you went back the second time, and this was going to be for a lot longer.
Well, then the second time, Nigel, the 5-year contract, there wasn't accommodation for me. Anyway, we decided that I would become pregnant. Although we only had a month and a half. But we succeeded in that object. So that I was going to stay at home while I was pregnant and have the baby and then go down with the baby. Because that was all right, although we didn't tell anybody.
That wasn't seen at all as unusual, no. Taking a young child.
No, because not many young children went from UK previously, but quite a lot from Falkland had. Because quite a lot of the married families came from Falkland. Although, the Matthews brought down a 3-year-old when I was first there, and then when I was there second time, the German dentist and his wife had a son with them, and then she went back to Germany to have a baby. She was pregnant on the island, but went back. And Jean Matthews went back to have a second child.
What did your family in the UK think about you taking a young child?
I'm thinking about them now. I think they were very good because they didn't say, don't do it. But they must have been devastated because it was both families' first grandchild. And I think they were horrified. But they didn't try and persuade us not to go.
What did they think about you going south the first time? I mean, that must have been seen as quite an adventurous, unusual thing to do.
Yes, it was. I think they were quite worried. But I think their attitude was that if Nigel felt it was all right for me to do it, it probably was. So I think they thought that Nigel wouldn't put me in danger.
And what about you? I mean, you're a new mum.
Did you
have worries?
Yes, I did. I had worries. I was pretty confident person, actually. I had looked after babies for other people, for, you know, babysat and that sort of thing. I went clasping Dr. Spock's book, which is denigrated now, but was written exactly for somebody like me. It was written for American young mothers who were away from doctors and older women or experienced mothers. So it was exactly what I needed. And he anticipated everything that you might come across and told you what to do if there was illness, when you had to go and see a doctor, however difficult, or get a hold of a doctor. And I had that, and it was wonderful. I was very impressed with that. And I knew that there weren't many illnesses on the island, and only those, if a ship had been to Falkland, or South America and came to the island within a week, then it often brought colds with it. But otherwise, we got very little illness at all. And it was only accidents. The other thing was feeding Martin. I wasn't quite sure. I knew that there was adequate food there. The whaling stations brought down food, but some of it wasn't as, you know, fresh. There wasn't a lot of... I imagine there wasn't a lot of fresh vegetables or fresh fruit. And I wrote to Heinz and asked them if they could give me an idea of what Heinz tin food I'd need for bringing up a child from 4 months old to when it was on fully on adult food. And they rang me up and said they were very interested and they'd certainly do it. And if they could use me and the baby as advertising material, they'd certainly help me. And I said, well, what sort of advertising? And I could hear the man the other end pulling himself up, and he said, madam, we're Heinz, as if to say, Heinz don't do anything, you know, unpleasant. So I said yes. And in the end, they gave me 1,200 cans of baby food for free in exchange for a big advert, which I can show you, in the Grocer's Gazette, which ends up to Mr. and Mrs. Bonner, we wish bon voyage. To Martin, we wish bon appetit.
Wonderful. And so how did you travel down to South Georgia with Martin? This was in 1958.
He was born in April, and we left at the end of August. We were going to, well, the idea was that we should all travel down together, but there wasn't room for me to get from South America to South Georgia when Nigel went down for the start of the sealing season, because they were taking down the sealers and men from to do repairs or something early. So I travelled down in the height of luxury on one of the Highland Princesses, which was a mail ship going down. So I travelled first class and sat at the captain's table, because I was a government official's wife and therefore I was suitable material for the captain's table. And it took us 3 weeks to get to Montevideo. We couldn't go to Buenos Aires because at that time England and Argentina were rowing about the Falklands. And so we went to Monte. And that was a wonderful journey because I was looked after so well, and the stewardess was lovely. She was an older lady. Well, I thought she was older. Now I think she was quite young. And she looked after me like a mother. But I didn't go ashore because it would have been difficult with Martin. And although other people would have helped me, I felt that would, you know... So we stopped at Vigo and Las Palmas and Recife, I think, and down somewhere in Brazil, and then to Montevideo. And I stayed on the ship for the rest of that day, and then I was collected and taken across to a Norwegian oil tanker, which hadn't been converted. And I was just appalled. The ship looked so grubby and the deck was covered in what looked like rubbish to me. and there were a lot of men swarming around who didn't appear to be doing anything productive. Anyway, a rotund Latin gentleman came down the gangplank and greeted me, and he was the commissario. And soon after him, a blonde, tall blonde man came down, and he was the captain. And the commissario took the baby from me, handed it to the captain, and we went up, you know, to my cabin, which was the second officer's cabin. And the captain said, you know, now what about the baby's meals? And I said, well, I feed him milk. And sort of a look of relief came over his face. And I didn't find out until a year later that apparently there was fuel oil in the drinking water tank, a small quantity of fuel oil. And they treated it for us and they got rid of it. But he was worried about a baby drinking, you know, having their milk. So, and then I had my tins of Heinz baby food, so that was all right. But there wasn't any hot water. In fact, there wasn't almost any water dripping into the basin that was in my cabin. And so when I wanted to do washing or to do bath Martin, three men had to carry two buckets each of hot water, one of cold and one of hot, across from the, you know how a tanker is, with the engine one end and the bridge, the other end. Well, I was living in the bridge area, to provide me with water. But I did the washing in the captain's bathroom, which was next to his cabin, and he provided special washing powder for babies and and pegs for hanging the washing up. And then one day he asked me if I'd like a bath, and I said yes, that would be nice. So a lock was put on the bathroom door, although they'd have to, you know, and there was a towel draped over the porthole. And then three men had to make goodness knows how many walks along. And the weather was not too good, but they did it. And I had this luxurious bath because I'd been sort of topping and tailing in the water after I bathed Martin.
What's the name of the ship?
Conquistador. And it was owned by the Compagnia Argentina de Pesca, which was... everybody on board was really kind to me. The first meal, I noticed that the other officers kept their knife and fork from their first course, so I did the same. But I wasn't allowed to do that. I had to put my knife and fork back. And I had clean knives and forks for every course. And I had a proper napkin. I don't think anybody else had a napkin, but I had a napkin. And I used to keep out of the cabin, the mess room, because they all had to speak. Some of them didn't speak English, but those that spoke English, when I was in the cabin, spoke English to me and to each other. And I felt that was a bit hard. But after the second day, they came and got me about 3 o'clock and said, why didn't I bring the baby into the mess room and have tea with them? And so I did. And then in the evening, when Martin was asleep, I'd go in and play canasta with them. But it just took a week from, and we had very good weather until the last day, when the fog came down. So I didn't see South Georgia when I went in next time.
Nigel must have been incredibly relieved, I imagine, to see you arriving.
Oh, he was. He came out with the pilot boat, and. So that was lovely. And the only time that Martin really cried was when Nigel picked him up And he got this reputation of this baby that didn't cry.